Okay, this is an interview with Mark Bobick, the Youngstown State University Oral History Program's Prisoner of War Project by Jeffrey Scott Sahonik. This interview is being conducted at Mr. Bobick's home, which is at 9729 Barr, that's B-A-R-R Road, in Brecksville, Ohio, on this, the 23rd of April, 1981, at approximately 1:15 p.m. Mr. Bobick, let's begin with some information about your background, when and where you were born, something about your family.
Okay, I was born in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, January 4th, 1924. I was born and raised in the city. I worked after I graduated from high school for a short time because of the war. I worked at General Aviation, as assistant to a tool and die maker, and then I was just biding my time and was drafted into the Army, which ruined my outlook on my future education going to college, to King's College in Kingston, Pennsylvania. So the war interrupted that. Mm-hmm. So then I went into the induction center. We went to Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania, a processing center. From there, they gave us tests. Being half asleep in the morning or pulling KP, they give you these tests and you're half awake and half asleep and whatnot. To evaluate you, you would go. So I wound up going into the tank corps. I was sent to Camp Polk, Louisiana. I trained as a tank gunner. We learned the 75 millimeter, 50 caliber, 30 caliber, Tommy gun, 45 automatic, 45 pistol. After we got through all our training with the maneuvers and bivouacs and whatnot, we were then disbanded. I thought we were going to go over to Europe as a unit, as a tank outfit, the 8th Armored Division, but we didn't. Mm-hmm. They had taken us and separated us from our outfit and sent us to England, where we were going to join, thinking we were going to join an armed group. Mm-hmm. From there, we went to we had our little more training as far as running goes, and artillery range again with the tanks. We went to Bristol, and we're shooting into the bay, the channel, English mm-hmm. Channel, mm-hmm. on targets. Then from there we had gone to, we were put on boats and sent to Omaha Beach, where that was 1 week after D-Day.
Okay. Where was your port of embarkation here in the United States?
New York.
And
from New York, we went to Glasgow, Scotland. Mm-hmm. Glasgow, Scotland, we took a train, went to Wookie Wells, England. That's, I think, in Somerset. And from Somerset, we went to Southampton. From Southampton, that's where all the invasion forces had gathered, and we went to we were assigned to go up to the Omaha Beach. Mm-hmm. Right outside of St. Lo, we had been assigned to the 35th Infantry. At the time, I had my TO weapon, which is a weapon that you're assigned, your personal sidearm, which was a Tommy gun. When I got to the, first, we were introduced to a little ceremony that they gave a Silver Star to a fella called Miller. The colonel had saw my Tommy gun on my side, being that I was in infantry, took my Tommy gun and gave me his carbine. No, it wasn't carbine, it was an automatic. Gave me his automatic pistol holster, and From there, I went to our company area with the infantry, and the cook came over and he says, you're supposed to have a rifle. So he gave me his carbine and took the pistol. And after he took the pistol and I got to my platoon, the platoon leader took the carbine away from me and gave me an M1. And naturally, being in a tank outfit, we didn't know anything about rifles as far as breaking them down, cleaning them, maintenance, or loading, or anything else that goes with them, or sighting. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the training. We were trained in an armored outfit. Mm-hmm. I was supposed to be an armored personnel replacement because we didn't go over as a unit. So that was a real fiasco on the part of the American government. It's like training somebody with judo to go against a person who has taken training in ballet. Mm-hmm. After learning the rifle with a quick lesson there, I was assigned to platoon. Then from there on, we had engaged the enemy, and from there we went all the way as far as the Moselle River.
Okay, I want to... getting back to your time in England, how long did you spend in England before you actually went over to France?
Oh, about 3 weeks to a month.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, what they were doing was just regrouping everything, gathering, amassing everything. Mm-hmm. Even though the war was still going on, it was just a preparation before the initial invasion of D-Day. Their Project Overlord.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a matter of massing personnel and troops, equipment, and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, when Hitler came up to the coast of France, all he had to do was cross the coast of France and he would have had England in the grasp of his hand.
Mm-hmm.
But he hesitated, and that was his downfall. But meanwhile, because the Air Force in England wasn't, they were taxed to the limit because of the number of pilots that they didn't have, that they needed, and people that were pilots, a lot of them came from countries like Poland and other nations over there, France, that joined the RAF because the occupation of their native countries. Being that they did know how to fly, that they did take over
mm-hmm.
and fly some of their Spitfires against the enemy.
Did you meet any of these people?
Yes, I had a neighbor, two neighbors as a matter of fact. One was in an English submarine outfit and the other one was Stan Zanowitz. He was a pilot. He was a neighbor of mine when I lived in Lakewood, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a Polish fighter pilot. And after the occupation downfall of Pope, he had gone to England and fought there on the side of the English. And then later on, after the war, he had come back here to America
mm-hmm.
with his English wife.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, he has died.
Did you get to go into Glasgow or any of the towns in England? What was the reaction of the people towards Americans?
The English people themselves are very, very reserved people, and I imagine there were cases where they were friendly. The only time they were, well, you might say, friendly would be if they're in a pub. If they talk to you, fine. If they don't, it seemed like they wanted their privacy respected.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't an open type of people who would want to go ahead and, take you into their home openly, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they were very, very cold people, in my estimation.
Mm-hmm.
I found that the French people were a little bit warmer, especially... like when our front was moving up, we'd stop at a farmhouse and they would give you some wine. They'd go out into the fields and dig up boxes of wine that they had hidden from the Germans. Otherwise, it would have been confiscated.
Mm-hmm.
They would give you a bottle of wine or cognac of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever go into London?
No, I've never had the opportunity to go to London. The only place I spent most of my time was around the area of Wookie Wells, which is a sort of scenic little town away from everything, like the Army usually picks out, you know. It's you're miles away from anywhere, and it's a crossroads, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a quaint little town with a little castle, with a moat around it and swans of that nature, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A pretty picturesque thing.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, why, there was nothing there. There was a cinema, two pubs. They did put on some dances at a hall institution, which happened to be it was a mental institution, but the hall itself, was the dance floor, was big enough for people to have a dance, and once in a while on the weekend they would put on a dance for the servicemen.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of that, why, we did get a chance to go to what they called Cheddar Caves. All that was a hike, really, when you come down to it. But as far as being able to go anywhere, we'd have the opportunity to go to London or anywhere else we had, which I would have liked to have done, you know, just to see.
Mm-hmm.
What had happened as far as the bombing of the V-2 bombings that were happening, and mm-hmm. The other bombings that were, and you know, just the condition of England itself,
mm-hmm.
which was really, you associate London with it. Other than that, why, that was the extent. Most of the time was spent in training and trying to learn signs, road signs, and what they meant, you know, as far as the German language and French language, so you know where you were going.
Mm-hmm.
Because they did have a lot of trickery where signs were being turned around on roads, putting you in an opposite direction,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. After that, why, there was not much more to do there in England as far as just getting prepared to move out, you mm-hmm. know.
Can you remember what you were doing when you heard, when you got the word that it was time to go?
It was never such thing as a time to go, you know. Everything was, you wouldn't call it secret or kept quiet, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Just that you were restricted to the area, and pack up your stuff. There's a possibility, it was always the word, the possibility you might move out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you really actually didn't know. You might pack your bag and then unpack it. You really didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
There are times like that where you'd hurry up and wait. But we did get word that we were restricted to the area, and then we got word, pack up our stuff, and we did our duffel bag and whatnot. And we got on the boats.
Mm-hmm. Now,
and
were you on the initial invasion fleet itself?
No, we were about a week after the invasion.
Okay.
But we did come up the Omaha Beach.
Mm-hmm.
And the rain on top of the, as we came up this, the beach itself was rather short. It wasn't a long beach like you would imagine a beach to be, with a high rise. And the engineers had formed a type of a road going up to the top, and at the top there was the cemetery of the American personnel that were killed at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right on top. Now, I don't know if that's still there or not, or whether they had moved those bodies to national memorial places, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But then from there we went to through St. Lo, which was leveled, and there was a little battle there, I guess, and just outside of St. Lo is when we had joined the 35th Infantry, because the 35th Infantry had suffered numerous casualties because of that battle, and had put a hole, you might say, in their line.
Mm-hmm.
So that had to be filled up. Well, naturally, they quickly took whoever you were there, whether you're a cook, candlestick maker, baker, flyer, or what,
mm-hmm.
and you were given a rifle, and irregardless of what your training was, where you'd be best qualified. So I felt very inadequate because of the training that I did get in the armored force, the tank outfit, and then to be put in the infantry, which meant a little awkward for me, because you do learn sign language and, you know, as far as your tactics would go. And over this, I had to, you want to say pick up overnight, you know. You learn there, or you're in a lot of trouble. So I did buddy up with a fella who had some experience, and he showed me the ropes, so to speak, and he watched out for me, and I watched out for him. You always sort of, you want to call it team up with somebody, or foxhole buddy, or whatever you want to call him. And from there, we had gone all the way down to the Moselle River, and then we had engaged the enemy again, just outside the Moselle River, where they had did put up a stand and were firing artillery at us. And going to the artillery fire, we had come upon a machine gun nest that was shooting at us and pinned our troops down on the road. So we went off to the side. Then we made work our way up after the machine gun nests were wiped out with rifle fire. We had proceeded through the woods and down to the river bank. Well, it was already, by the time we got down, it was nightfall. But we had crossed a bridge. We were, you might call, a point. So crossing the river, went across the bridge, which was still up at the time. But going across, you can see the aerial bombs that were attached to the bridge for detonation. Well, just across the bridge immediately to take, you know, take cover, get into position for your next skirmish. Why, not thinking a thing about those bombs, whether they were defused, you know, the wires cut or whatever. Well, if we were, at that time would have known that, we probably could have, you know, got word back. But being that everything was so intense at the time with the firing, the machine gun was zeroed in on the bridge, and everybody going across the bridge naturally was under fire. And the
Germans had the bridge covered then.
They had it covered, yeah. They were up on when I call it the terrain, had rose on the other side of the bridge, had rose a little bit, so they had an advantage of shooting down, you know, as opposed to even shooting flat, you know. They did have a good field of view, even though it was night. Evidently, they must have already set up and zeroed in on the bridge, a few bursts to know where they were going. And at the end of the bridge, there was a fellow there. After the fire was coming, we didn't know where it was coming from. Then he must have been hit, and he kept saying, get out of here, get off the bridge, he said, because it zeroed in, and evidently he was hit because he wasn't moving. Well, we took cover alongside the bank, and well, naturally the firing was going back and forth, and then after a short time, after there were more fire going on the bridge, there was nobody else came across. They cut us off. So we stayed there till the wee hours of morning, fighting back and forth to rifle fire and whatnot. Then the Germans brought down a Tiger tank, a armored personnel carrier, and one of those open, similar to our half track with troops, you know, and heavy firepower. Well, we fought all night until morning, and then the Germans came in, and it was either a matter of, under the command of our lieutenant, it was either a matter of trying to take chances, you know, jumping into the river, which was a pretty fast current at the time, or trying to hold out and see what's going to happen. Well, we tried to hold out, but it was to no avail. They immediately and very efficiently moved right in. Evidently, it seemed like it was a rehearsed program. They must have went through this once before. The tank moved in, and that stopped everything. By the time our heavy equipment would come up, well, we did have mortar fire from across the river from our side, and some BAR and rifle fire, but that was like being caught between two fires. So by early morning, Lieutenant finally decided that it was lost cause. There was no chance of us getting back over the bridge. And the German came in, the officer who spoke English, and he says, either give up or we'll wipe you all out. And it was like a nightmare, the way it just happened. It happened so suddenly, you know, mm-hmm. didn't know what was happening. Mm-hmm. And then from there, they had taken us, disarmed us, searched us for any items that we might have taken from other Germans mm-hmm. as souvenirs, you know.
Was that
they frowned
a bad
on that.
Thing?
Yeah, they frowned on that. I mean, if you were caught, why, you have a 50-50 chance of finding out whether or not you're going to survive this or not.
Mm-hmm. How wide was this river? Can you remember how wide it was?
Oh, God, it was quite wide. Mm-hmm. The Moselle River was wide at that point where we had crossed, because the when you cross the river, you turned left to go to Nancy.
Mm-hmm.
It was a wide river at that point.
Who was the lieutenant at this time?
Well, I don't remember his name offhand. I think he was from Pennsylvania. I'd have to look it up in a book. It's been quite a while.
Mm-hmm. How many of you were cut off?
Well, I'd say about 75, somewhere around that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't many, about 75,
mm-hmm.
which was a drop in the bucket with the amount of power the Germans had there at the time.
Mm-hmm. This was how many men would you say you were facing?
How many? Well, I would say it was just the German front, really. They had a Tiger tank there,
mm-hmm.
which had a firepower of 88 it carried. They had the half track. They had the some kind of a, what would you call it, armored personnel thing. It looked like a tank when it was open.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then they had a half track full of troops, plus all the troops that were all over the ground there, you know,
mm-hmm.
all the way around us.
Mm-hmm.
So we were between the river. We were on the side of the bank between the river mm-hmm. and the road. There was a road on top from mm-hmm. the when you crossed the bridge. It went left and right. Mainly it went left, but we were right in that section there, and that's all the troops that were there
mm-hmm.
that they got across at night.
Mm-hmm.
So we were going to try to get a toehold, but it didn't work out that way for us.
Now you said the Germans moved in like this had been rehearsed.
Yeah, evidently.
How did they go about, you know, neutralizing your positions where you just knew it was hopeless to continue?
Well, first of all, they must have been there before, because the machine gun nest up in the woods that had a field of view of firing down the road where we were coming down the road.
Mm-hmm.
They were dug in, so they must have been for some time in order to dig in
mm-hmm.
to make a nest. The bridge that was zeroed in with the machine guns, they must have been there for some time in order to set up and also zero mm-hmm. in the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Evidently, they must have been controlling this.
Mm-hmm.
So when we were coming down and we were engaging them, evidently, I imagine they had called up for the tanks and whatnot to come in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when the tanks came in, that was bad news, you know.
All you had was small arms?
Yeah, I had a M1.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which was useless against a
yeah.
tank.
I had no grenades on me at the time. You had hand grenades, there was a possibility you could climb up on a tank and throw it down in the turret, you know,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
or something of that nature, you know, but we didn't have it at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And from there, it was just a matter of time when the tanks came in. They had one come completely down to the riverbank and did fire. As a matter of fact, I was underneath the tank when they did fire, And the muzzle blast just about tore my head off because I had my chin strap on my helmet. But, you know, they don't recommend that anymore. So that's like taking a noose, you know, and pulling it. So, and that was a good opportunity for me to be able to get up there, you know. Mm-hmm. But without grenades, if you're lucky, you can hit them. And if not, well, you're in a lot of trouble because there was too many troops to be able to get up and maybe get the tank commander and then later on get somebody else inside.
I wanted to ask you, the first time you were going into combat, and you were being shot at, did it seem like it was real at first?
No. Uh-uh. It doesn't. People think that you're scared. I'll tell you that after the first skirmish, you're scared because you know they're out to get you, and it's just like an animal that you're chasing. He knows you're after him, and you have the same feeling. But going in initially, you didn't have that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But as you went along, you did, and it grew more and more. There are some of them that you want to say that like actually became shell shock, you know, like when we were down the road and they were firing the artillery. Well, as long as we were keeping moving, mm-hmm. because we were up front and point, as long as we kept moving, the shells were falling behind us. But if we would have stopped and slowed down, with them lowering and raising their sights, they would just spread a field of fire, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, they would cover a large area.
Mm-hmm.
But raising and lowering the gun, they would, in that manner, spread a field of fire.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were realized that you had been captured,
mm-hmm.
you said it was like a nightmare.
Can you describe your
feelings that...
It was unbelievable that we were taken. It was hard for me to know that we were taken. I just didn't believe that, you know, it was possible that they could have taken us so quickly, you know.
Mm-hmm.
After you sat down and began to analyze it, you said, well, geez, first of all, we didn't have the amount of people.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, somebody trying to shoot down a whole squadron of planes as opposed to one plane, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's going to get through and somebody isn't. And in our case, being up in point, I don't know if that you call them the sacrifice or what, you know. Somebody's got to feel them out.
Right.
So going up in point, that more or less is, you want to call it a sacrifice, and I guess we were it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way I can look at it myself.
Mm-hmm. How were you treated initially, as soon as you were, say, under guard, and they had taken your weapons? Was that sort of a funny feeling to be under guard?
Well, yes, it wasn't very comfortable because you didn't know what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You could have been shot. You didn't know what was going to happen. But the soldier on the front seemed to have a little respect for one another. They're all in the same boat.
Mm-hmm.
There was a little bit of respect, which didn't hold true for everybody. You always got somebody in a crowd who doesn't like to go along with what you want to call the norm.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine he was a medic, because the lieutenant, I didn't know German at all as far as the language goes.
Mm-hmm.
I did be able to speak a little of a few words of French, quite a bit of Polish, but I didn't have the knowledge of German, which later on I had picked up, being that you're immersed into it, why you did pick it up. He did come over and my hand was bleeding, and he looked at it. I don't know what he did, because I was so damn scared. You were like, mesmerized,
mm-hmm.
paralyzed. I don't know how to put it, but state of shock. And he did come over and look at my hand. It was bleeding. And he wrapped some kind of it wasn't a cloth bandage. To me, it felt like crepe paper. It felt like paper. He looked at it. He put something on it, a powder. I assumed it was sulfur powder.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I was hit. The other fella, he had a bullet in his leg. They had taken him on a, it looked like a jeep. I don't know where they took him. They must have taken him to the hospital, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
They may have taken him around the bend. I don't know. Who knows? But the group of us, they did take us. I would say there was about 50 to 75 of us at the most. They did take us to Nancy, which must have been their, you want to call it CP point, the central point,
mm-hmm.
command post, whatever. They interrogated us. They interrogated me. They pulled me out of the line,
mm-hmm.
and just like in the movies, you know.
Just at random.
Yeah. They pick out one here, and you know,
mm-hmm.
take him in, question him.
What did they ask you?
They wanted to ask me what outfit I was with, and I told them, "You can read. There's a patch on my shoulder." I wouldn't tell them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're that dumb, you know, and you can't read the patch, why? He knew I was in the infantry, naturally.
Mm-hmm.
But I just gave my name, rank, and serial number, and that's it. But it was just like in the movies where the light is dim, you know, and everybody's standing around, and one guy clinging his bayonet, you know, to create an atmosphere of
mm-hmm.
uncertainty. As a result of being interrogated, they did give out a little ration of a little bit of bread, and I think it was some type of a sausage or meat or something it was, to the prisoners. But being I was interrogated, I had missed my turn in line, and I didn't get any. From there, they had put us on boxcars. And we rode in those boxcars for about, I'd say maybe a week. It's hard for me to tell the time. It was long.
Mm-hmm.
And we were transferred from there to Limburg, Germany, which is Stalag 12A. And being that I didn't talk to the officer in charge, to let him know what outfit I was in and probably all of the conditions that he wanted to know.
Uh-huh.
One of the soldiers in the back gave me a good belt to the back, and because I wasn't cooperative, or to let me know that, to humiliate me, I don't know.
This was upon arriving?
No, this was when I was being interrogated at Nancy, France.
Oh, okay.
When they pulled me out of line,
mm-hmm.
they had us in this courtyard. And then we were put on the boxcars, and we were sent to Limburg, Stalag 12A.
Mm-hmm.
Well, during that trip, all that while, I had no food. And they had roughly about 50 of us in a boxcar. And we got to 12A, we did notice that there were other people, troops that were being brought in too, but what outfit they were from or where they came from, we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
The camp itself was compounded. They did have Russian in there and I imagine French and whatnot. If you had cigarettes, then you were able to barter for bread.
Mm-hmm.
They would throw a loaf of bread over the fence wire, and you would throw your cigarettes to them, or you'd throw your cigarettes first, you know,
mm-hmm.
trade.
Mm-hmm. With the guards? or with these other prisoners?
With the other prisoners.
Okay, you were separated then in different sections?
Yeah. We stayed in an area that had tents. It wasn't a barracks type of or building, you know, a billet.
Mm-hmm.
It was all muddy. They had straw on the ground, which after the rainfall, you know, it was just a holy mess. It looked like a pig pen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
All that mud walking around in there.
Mm-hmm.
You had to sleep on the ground. You had no beds. You had a water pipe coming up out of the ground, which the water was turned on, and it flowed on the ground. So you had a well to get some water. You had to go back into that mud again. And then they turned it off whenever they liked it. And then from time to time, a German guard would come in with German Shepherd dogs, depending upon who came in. Sometimes they had pincers, sometimes they had German Shepherds. Well, if you were thirsty, you wanted a drink of water, naturally you're going to go to the water. Well, I must, not knowing their language and what he was saying, evidently they might have had a curfew or something. I don't know what it was, but they would sick the dogs on you.
Mm-hmm.
Get you away from the water. And then from there, we stayed for a short time, and we were sent back into the boxcars, and we were sent to Mühlberg, which was 4B, Stalag 4B. And we had a ride in the boxcars again. These boxcar rides were really something too, because we did have our Air Force coming all the time. Naturally, they were out to get the trains,
mm-hmm.
to stop troop movement, equipment movement, whatnot. But how did they know what's in the boxcar? So they had little windows with bars on them that we were holding our jackets out, our OD jackets or shirts, anything that had OD.
Mm-hmm.
Hoping that maybe the pilot, I don't know if they could have seen it or not, that there was people in there. Now, whether they were rehearsed or not, or given this information with their instructions from the Air Force, I don't know. In regard to the people that are being shipped to the concentration camps by the Germans,
mm-hmm.
Letting the pilots know that to watch what you're shooting,
mm-hmm.
Go for the locomotive as opposed to the train itself, unless they knew that there was troops on there.
So were you strafed or anything? Was the train attacked?
We were strafed one time. At one point, we were strafed only one time. Other time, the plane itself had just buzzed us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in other words, he looked us over. And which was a good thing. Except for other instance, when we were being transferred, I think it was from Mühlberg to Moosburg, when they had a bombing. Our Air Force bombed the tracks out, the locomotive yard. That stopped the train, but we weren't shot at that time. It's just that we were stopped.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether they derouted us or how they got us through, I don't know. So then, from Limburg, naturally to 4B in Mühlberg,
mm-hmm.
and those were barracks. There, where they had photographed you, assigned you your number.
Why were you transferred, do you know?
I don't know. I have no idea. I have no idea why they... As the front was shrinking,
mm-hmm.
They were pulling people back. Why, I have no idea. I could never figure that out.
Mm-hmm. Were these large camps? Describe the camp at Limburg.
Limburg was a large camp.
Mm-hmm. Was it ringed by barbed wire?
It had barbed wire. It had towers.
How many towers?
The only one that I can see was from my vantage point to where we were. There was just the one on the one corner,
mm-hmm.
and the railroad was close by. And you always have the thought in your mind coming to you, maybe I could sneak out and
mm-hmm.
get down along the tracks and get the hell out of here, but there was no such animal, you know.
Mm-hmm. How many guards would they normally
Well, you had the gun towers, you had the double row of barbed wire, then they had a fine strand of one single barbed wire where you weren't allowed to go over that.
That was inside the...
That was inside the compound.
If you went over that,
what
happened?
In other words, you had the fence and then you had this wire and you weren't allowed. Anybody over that was shot at.
Do you know anybody that was shot at for doing that?
Not a fan, no. Mm-hmm. I wasn't there that long. I was there about a week, I think,
mm-hmm.
when we were transferred.
Mm-hmm.
Other than having the dogs come in and to move around like sheep, you know, to make you, you know, you're at a disadvantage when you don't know what the hell they're saying, you know.
Right.
So you can play their game. Type of a soup. But you could put a soup strain in your food, and I don't think you'd pick up a vegetable or a piece of meat or whatever. From there, we were transferred to, took that train and sent to Rosenheim, which is along the Inn River. And we stayed there. I stayed there for the battle until we were liberated in May by the 45th Infantry.
Mm-hmm.
There we did have a regular scheduled work day. But they had sent us out to work. We had gone to fill in the dikes along the Inn River that were bombed. We were sent to the railroad yards to fix up the craters, mm-hmm. fill in the craters
mm-hmm.
That the Air Force had bombed. And then at the same time, while you were working at these different projects, you were constantly bombed by your own Air Force. It was just like the one instance where we were working along the track, filling in some holes, and the air raid siren sounded, and a guard had taken us down to the air raid shelter. And our planes come over and loaded their load right on top of us. We were, I don't know, but the good Lord, somebody must have been watching over us to get out of it.
What was your attitude? What was the attitude of the men when they were getting bombed by their own Air Force?
They were glad. We were glad. We knew they were coming. And we knew that these people knew it.
Did you see an attitude change?
There's an attitude change in even the German who sat next to you would pull out his wallet and show you a photograph of his wife and his kids. And show you that it was his Frau, and this is my Kinder,
mm-hmm.
you know. And their attitude would change completely, but we didn't care. For some reason or another, you felt good because even though you were being bombed, and the plaster was falling off the ceiling, and the light was swaying, and all this dust was filling in the room, it didn't bother you.
Mm-hmm.
You were frightened to a point.
Yes. You have to be...
Totally unfeeling not to be aware of it,
mm-hmm.
but you had a good feeling of knowing that they're there.
Mm-hmm.
They're still in it.
Well,
we're in Rosenheim. We're put on.
We're all the commando. They were kind of the commando.
4071. There we worked along the river. We filled in the hole in the dike. You can see the snow-capped mountains, the Alps.
Mm-hmm.
Then your mind is going again, you know, possibly getting away.
Mm-hmm. Were there
we were taken to Kufstein to work on a cement detail. And we had loaded cement onto boxcar trucks.
Mm-hmm.
And they were taking them to wherever they needed to. I guess the Germans must have been a rail yard, a little siding of some type, you know, where these cement cars were brought, and we were unloading them. Some of the fellas thought it would be a pretty good idea. Well, we're this far into Kufstein, so close to the border.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think we'll take off, you know? Sounds like a good idea. We had a Frenchman working with us, and he says, he could talk English. He says, I overheard you. And we didn't realize that he was
mm-hmm.
able to,
understand.
To understand what we were talking about, because, you know, a lot of times you make comments about the Germans, and to see if they knew what, you know, mm-hmm. you call them a name or something like that, see if they know what you're talking about. He told us, he says, if you guys think you're going to go, just forget. First of all, he says, I've been here 6 years. He says, one time I had a pass to be able to get through. He says, they cut me. He says, another time he tried to go on foot. He says, they cut me. He says, it's so well guarded and policed with dogs. And the border itself is so hard to get through, especially if you're going to go through the mountain, which you'd have to go through the snow-capped mountain.
Mm-hmm.
He says, forget it. He says, you're not going to get through. He says, well, at least with me, he says, I was able to get on a train and ride like a regular civilian to get through. He says, mm-hmm. but you have nothing. So he went ahead and he did that. And from there, we were sent back to our company area, our camp there, whatever you want to call it. Two of the guys had taken off. One was Nate Neskridge from Muskogee, Oklahoma, and another fella. They had taken off. They told the guard that they had to go to the bathroom. Well, the guard had to make up his mind whether he was going to let two of them go to the bathroom or let the other six, you know,
mm-hmm.
whether he was going to go to two or stay with the six. So he stayed with the six, mm-hmm. and the two took off. Well, they were gone only about 5 hours. They were brought back in the morning. What they did, they had gone down along the road, which was leading again to the Brenner Pass,
mm-hmm.
and the Hitler Youth were out on night maneuvers. So they were brought, they were captured again and brought back.
By Hitler Youth?
Well, they had German troops with them, mm-hmm. you know, training the young people.
Mm-hmm.
So the troops did bring them back. There was two of them that came back with them. They were reprimanded by the company officer there in our area there. They had one, the corporal, he was in charge of this little billet. I think we had 50 guys in this billet. And they had reprimanded him. They put them in a potato cellar. I think they were in there for two days to a week. You know, no food, no nothing.
Mm-hmm.
They put them in there. Then they brought him out. Well, we had roll call. That time they would bring him out like a roll call.
Mm-hmm.
And we always managed to slip them a piece of bread, you know, put it in their hand. And they were put down in there. Well, later on we found out that there was potatoes in there. So they were eating raw potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
So they had some food value getting into them. And they told him after that next time you go and do that, you're going to be killed. You're going to be shot. You're mm-hmm. not going to be brought back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the only maybe escape attempt that you knew of?
Yeah, well, he tried one. We were at the railroad station, and it was the same deal. We were going to go and take a pee
mm-hmm.
and then take off, see?
Mm-hmm. Well,
we went in the bathroom. We opened up the window, looked out, and there was nobody there. Oh, so we started to climb up. Just then, these German, what we're going to call them, soldiers, the troops or whatever, they began to walk around outside the building, so we had to go back in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're just about halfway out to the waist, you know, and then back in we had to go.
Mm-hmm.
So then we had to get back on the train again, and off mm-hmm. we went. That was the only time.
Mm-hmm.
The other times, we just harassed them as much as we could to take a cigarette and put the cigarette in a match cover, you know. You open up the match cover and put the cigarette in there
mm-hmm.
and then close it. And while the cigarette is burning, when it hits the match heads, it creates so much BTUs, you know, when it takes off. Well, as we'd go through a railroad yard, we'd see any box cars or anything that are open. We would just throw this
uh-huh.
pack of matches with the cigarettes into it, see. And once the cigarette burned down to the match head, then it started a fire.
Mm-hmm.
So we were trying that for a while, and then they didn't have any toilet facilities on the on these trains, you know, the box cars with the transport. They had a box there full of straw. Now, you were supposed to urinate in that. You're supposed to go potty on it, you know. So what we would do is we would go potty on whatever we could that we can pick it up with. And as we went through the stations or through the towns, we threw it at the whoever was there, you know, at the people or whatever. I mean, it was nasty, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But anything to let them know our disfeeling and dissatisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
How much contact did you have with the German soldiers themselves, the German population?
German population, we didn't have too much. The German soldiers, we didn't have too much. You did what they told you to do, and that was it. There was, as far as communication goes, trying to talk too much about it. Very little. The only ones that talked to you about anything or anything would be if he was a civilian who was a guard.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would say, yeah, I was back in Chicago and I liked it there. The one he mentioned that he was on the train and he liked the porters, you know, how well they waited on him, you know, because the porter get a tip, you know. So he enjoyed that, you know, the courtesy that he received when he was in Chicago, you know, or they'll tell you, well, I got an uncle in New York or something like that, you know. Someday I'm going to go back. You're fighting a war and they're telling you someday they're going to go back.
Mm-hmm. What was their attitude towards you as soldiers? Were you a despised enemy, or since the war was coming to a close, did they try to buddy up to you?
No, they tried to buddy up to you, but the war, they knew that it was coming to an end. As a matter of fact, we had no radio or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody did have a radio, they kept it quiet because it would be taken away from you. But the guard, when Roosevelt died, one of the guards come up and actually told us. He says, and he felt bad about it, and which surprised me is the fact that here's a German who's fighting the Americans, felt bad about it. From what I gather, through all this whole thing, it seemed to me like the German populace itself had no animosity against the American public. Why, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Their homes were being bombed and everything. And
yeah. It, you know, the American, I guess maybe because the war was so close to an end, and now they had to pay for everything that they did with the ravaging of the Balkan, the treatment that they gave to all the people in the concentration camps, all the atrocities that they performed. I guess maybe their conscience was get the best of them, really.
Do you think they felt relieved that maybe it was finally going to be over?
Well, I think a lot of them are going to be relieved because of the war is going to be over, because I think they had their belly full of a losing war.
Mm-hmm.
They enjoyed the fruits at the beginning when they were the victors. The victors got the spoils, but then after the victors became losers, well, then that was another story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they had their stomach full of being woke up at night by Bedcheck Charlie, who came over with his air raid. And got them out of bed.
Mm-hmm.
They had to run to the air raid shelter.
Mm-hmm.
Or during the day, never being able to sit down, always wondering, well, I got my kids at home, I'm out here, what's happening? You know, here's the air raid, you know, are they okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you go home, you find out, hey, my house is gone, my whole family's gone. You know, one of those things where that was happening, the same thing in London, when they sent the buzz bombs over after the fuel was used up and it came down. Well, you didn't know where it was going to hit, you know. Off you had gone to work, when you come back, there probably was no building there.
Mm-hmm.
There was probably one building, maybe the whole block wasn't there. So, we had a fella, Randy Brooks, from Gary, Indiana. He was sort of a buddy of mine, if you want to call it. We had met in one of the camps. And we buddied up together. He was also in this camp in 407-1 with me. One of our details was to go to the hospital, which was across the street from this billet where we were kept, this little prison camp, and take the personnel, the patients, down to the air raid shelter. The reason why they did that is because if there was any bombing, not saying that the Air Force is going to bomb the hospital, because it was definitely marked. But they would take the people down to the air raid shelter, because when the debris flew, it would smash the windows, and then they could get cut with glass, which added a little more complications to their problems of even trying to get these people recuperated to get out of there.
Mm-hmm. Now, were these civilians or soldiers?
They were mixed. They were civilians and they were soldiers. Most of them were all soldiers. Mm-hmm. And in the back, they had a garage. You've probably seen five-car garages, you know, all these doors on them. It was a makeshift morgue where a lot of these people, troops, were died en route. And you had people that would come there. We were put on a detail to go over there, would come to identify, you know, their loved ones, or maybe a son or brother or father, whoever it might be. You'd see them going over these bodies, lifting up the sheets, so to speak, and look to see who's underneath there. Some cases they didn't even have a sheet. They might have had a jacket or a hat over the patient. And trying to identify somebody, you know. I was up on the fifth floor one time, and they had an operation, and we were waiting. The air raid sounded, and then it gave the all clear signal, so, but they kept us there anyway, because evidently the Air Force must have made a turn, you know. They were coming straight, probably turned and went to another direction, so they called the raid off. They handed me a package and told me to throw it down the incinerator chute, you know. Some of them could talk good English, and some could talk just a little bit. We had taken it and thrown this package down the chute, and here it was a leg. It was wrapped up in paper. Oh, I didn't know it, you know. They just performed an operation on one of the soldiers and had cut his head up. What I'm getting at is the fact that we were working at that hospital constantly all the time. Randy Brooks had come down with a cold and developed some type of a either pneumonia or whatever you want to call it, some kind of respiratory problem. And then he got a fever and he got sick. Yet, with that hospital that was across the street, they didn't give him any medical attention. And he got so bad to where he was having what you want to call it, the death rattle already, this heavy breathing. And in comes a German officer with another soldier. He talked to the commander of the camp, one of the, I guess, the details of what was happening there. He had a little black case with him, about like that, like a little pencil case. He went upstairs and gave Randy a shot. Came downstairs, told us to go upstairs and get the body. They already had the box to bury him. And now whether he gave him an air bubble or shot some kind of a drug into him to kill him or what. But Randy died. And I wrote his mother after the war. And she sent me back a nice letter. I told her details of his death, what his possible cause was. And yet, across the street was a hospital, and we couldn't get any medical attention.
Was this, would you say this was par about the medical attention the prisoners received? What kind of...
There was no such thing as getting attention, you know, what you want to call, like if you went to your own doctor to get medical attention you were given, and you were given a truth. And you never knew what they were giving you. Whether they're giving you pressed sugar or pressed baking soda, you don't know what the hell they were giving you. If they did give you anything. But what would they give if they didn't have nothing for themselves to go around? They may have checked you and said, well, you're fine, you know. Maybe give you a little colored water to drink, and thinking that the psychology will work on you and you'll heal yourself, you know. I don't know.
How about
him? But then when Randy died, we had went upstairs and got him out of the bunk. We had two tiered bunks. He slept on top. We took him and put him into this box. The box is that European style with the, like that, cut off, you know.
Hexagon kind of thing.
Yeah. And they put the lid on, and when they put him in there, I looked inside, and they had, it looked like wrapping paper, like you had in this meat market. And on the bottom was wood shavings, like you'd have in a carpenter's shop, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then this paper was there. They laid him on that, covered him with the, this paper, and put this lid on, and put the two pins on. Then we were given the privilege of, you might call, giving him a military escort, military funeral.
Mm-hmm.
We put him on our shoulders and took him to the cemetery. And there we lowered him into the grave. One of the fellows had one of the invasion patches on his shoulder, the American flag. He had taken that off, and he made a cross, and we put that on the cross. And we put his name on there as best as we could, so we'd know where he's at, because when we went to dig graves in that cemetery, we had dug what you call a mass grave, because when they had an air raid, a number of people would be killed or would die from their injury. They would maybe have 10 or 12 deep, and they would even bury them maybe too high. We had to dig them they call it 6 stoop or 6 meters or whatever it is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I forget what it is. And they would even bury him too high. And we buried Randy in a single grave. He was close to an Englishman who had died, from what I understand later on. I didn't know that because I didn't see any markings on the grave. Now, whether they had a plan of some type of where they kept number records like they do in some cemeteries of the location of the grave, I don't know. But I did find out later on through correspondence with his sister that an Englishman did die there.
You mentioned these mass graves. These were civilians they were?
They were buried? Everything. They were prisoners, Russian. See, the labor that was in town, you had Polish labor, you had Lithuanian labor, you had Italian labor, you had Russian labor. I hate to say this, but when a Russian died, we were sort of glad, because when they buried the Russian, they would take coins and throw coins on the grave after they buried them. And while we worked there, we would go over there and pick the coins off and see if we could get the guard, the civilian guard, to get us bread, you know.
That kind of bartering happen often?
Right. Not that often, but often enough, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It all depended what guard it was. Mm-hmm. There's always one that was always, he would take sides, especially the one that was in Chicago, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He had some feeling. But when a soldier did come around, a regular military soldier would come around, he was a civilian guard, then he would snap to it, you know. Then he was all German.
Right.
He was no longer civilian. He was military.
Mm-hmm. These mass graves, would they bury them all in boxes, or would they just?
They're in boxes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. These were civilian. Mm-hmm. They were put in just a wooden box, plain wooden box, just like Randy was put in.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, I found out that Randy was transferred here in Marion, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
They had shipped his body back. And she sent me a photograph of the cross that was on Randy's grave. Now, the cross that we made was just a plain cross with the American flag on it. And we tried to put some type of a marking on it, you know. The photograph that she sent me, it was a stat copy. It had the board that was across. You ever see those?
Yeah.
Like a roof type of a
right.
thing? I didn't recognize that, and I'm afraid to write back and say, well, I don't think that's Randy's grave, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, since we had gone, there's a chance that maybe the Germans did, who take care of the cemetery, change that. And I didn't want to create a problem and doubt in her mind. And I figured, well, I better just let it alone. If Randy is going to get any reward, the good Lord will take care of him no matter where he's at, whether he's there or here. And I figured, I'm just going to leave it alone. I won't touch it.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, that was not the cross on the grave that we made. Now, like I said, there was the possibility of changing it.
Keep mentioning these air raids. Were these frequent
They were often. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Especially towards the end. They were more frequent towards the end than they were at any time. A lot of times there would be, the air raid would sound off, and they wouldn't be a raid, you know. Mm-hmm. They would just be passing through. But being that they were up there, there was always the possibility, I guess, that the Germans figured the sound of raid and get the people in there. You never know, you know.
Could you see the planes? Could the prisoners see the planes? Could they hear them?
You can see the airstream. Oh,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Were there many of them?
They were just what you want to call like flights, squadrons, or whatever you want to call them, flights.
Mm-hmm.
The only time we saw many was towards the very end of the war. I think it was either just before we got liberated. I think it was either April. It was either April or early May. You'll never see anything like this in all your life. I don't think you'll ever even see anything like this. When I looked up at the sky, when they had this air raid, it looked like they were heading for Stuttgart,
mm-hmm.
from the direction from where we were standing. The sky was black. I think anything that flew was put up into that air.
Mm-hmm.
Never seen like this in all my life.
Did that create any excitement in the camp?
Well, it sure did. We knew something was up.
Mm-hmm.
And then it wasn't too long later, we heard artillery fire, and then small arms fire,
mm-hmm.
and then at night, the guards from our camp had taken off, locked us up. They used to take our pants at night, take our shoes away,
mm-hmm.
no matter what time, is it winter or summer.
Mm-hmm.
Take your pants off, take your shoes off, and they would lock them up.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to escape, you better have a pair of pants somewhere, because they'll pick you up.
Mm-hmm.
And when we heard this fire coming, you know, this was a few days after the raid. We heard this artillery. We knew the front was coming closer.
Mm-hmm.
We heard the artillery firing that night, you know, and then we had to go to the hospital again to take those patients because of the air raid. And we did one thing or another. Before you know it, why, then came the, what do you call it, the troops are coming up. Well, the Germans already taken off. We really wanted to get this one guy, this corporal, because we had a guy called there, Fischer. He was Jewish. Now, Fischer was complaining about bed bugs and whatnot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He was standing in the hallway there in his dim light that they had on it. You want to call it a night light or something on a staircase. The building was three floors.
Mm-hmm.
We slept on a second. The bottom floor was like a dining room, a toilet area, and a kitchen. And on the third floor was the corporal's quarters. And then there was the building that the other troops, the other guards, stayed in.
This was a German?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Fischer, he was one of our POWs, American POW. He was complaining about the bed bugs, or what do you want to call them, body lice or whatever they are.
Mm-hmm.
And he was picking them off of his body, you know, especially around his waistline where his clothing is tight. You know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, something that seemed like they congregated more where, you know, like around your ankle area where you might have stocking, or your waistline where your belt line would be,
mm-hmm.
your neckline. He was picking them off, and he began to complain to the guard. The guard wanted to know how come he's not in his bed, because they had curfew, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then he'd come in for what you call a bed check. Well, Fischer began to talk to him in Jewish, and Jewish and German is similar.
Mm-hmm.
And he was telling him, you know, so the guard had taken his bayonet out, and he put it up against Fischer, and he actually drew blood. He told him, get in your bed where you belong, and complaining. And then he started complaining some more. And he was asking to be transferred out of here. He wanted to get out of this camp. So they did take him, but we don't know where they took him. We don't know if they took him to another camp,
mm-hmm.
Whether they took them down in the river and dumped them in the river, we don't know what happened to them. But they did transfer them. They took them somewhere. Mm-hmm. I don't know where they took them.
Mm-hmm.
But the corporal did draw blood out of them.
How about other acts of brutality? Were they common? Or did the guards pretty much respect
the
prisoners?
There was the dogs in Stalag 12A, where the guards would sort of try to herd you like sheep because of the language barrier. That's the way I looked at it. You're telling you something, you know what the hell you're talking about. The one time I was in Munich at Moosberg, I got out of the boxcar too slowly. Naturally, you're weak after all this time.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got the language barrier again. And later on, you found out that los, los means hurry up, you know. I did get one rifle butt to the back, to my right hip. As a matter of fact, it still bothers me. And then they had no, oh, you want to call it a ladder or anything, to get down from the boxcar, so you had to jump down. That didn't help matters any. It just aggravated me all the more, you know. So I did have a slight limp at the time. And then it sort of, you want to say passed or healed or whatever it was, I don't know. But I did have it checked out, and the doctor did say I had some deterioration there.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
I mean, were men taken out and beaten or anything like that?
If they were, I didn't see them.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
And being that we were moved constantly, you didn't have too much contact, if you want to call, like 7B was more or less an English camp.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just transit. We didn't see too much of that. I guess maybe because we weren't in the camp itself at all times, you know, like some people were in camps, and they, just like the Japanese, a lot of them were in one camp maybe for years.
Mm-hmm.
If possibly they had transferred us from the beginning when they got us directly to a camp somewhere permanent, it would have been different. We didn't even know where we were going to go, mm-hmm. because there did come out an order later on. I found out that it was an Air Force group, that the order did come down for the German Army to eliminate this whole batch of airmen. Now, whether they were going to take them to a gas chamber somewhere or shoot them, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But this did come down. As you go along and talk to other people, you're going to pick up more and more people that had been in camps more permanent, you know, at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And you find out from other people that were treated real well, they might have been on a farm and say, hey, that was the best thing that happened to them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You don't, you know, as you go along, you're going to pick up different things because the circumstances are all different in all cases. If I was a medic or some kind of a doctor, probably when that hospital that was close by, maybe you might have wound up working in a hospital, and they would treated you a little more courtesy, you know, than normal.
Right.
But you did get every now and then, you did get a good shove or on that one occasion a good belt with a rifle butt to the back, you know, the right side. And I can't sleep on that side.
Mm-hmm. How were you kept informed about the progress of the war? Were you given any news at all of how things were going?
No. Where we didn't get anything, and what we got would be, you want to call it secondhand, so to speak, because, like, we went from Limburg to Mühlberg, from Mühlberg to Moosberg, from Moosberg to Rosenheim, you know,
and
constantly.
The other prisoners would tell you what they
knew? Yeah, what they knew, we would inquire, well, how's it gone? And you'd hear some things, and some things, you know, you didn't hear.
Mm-hmm.
You did have a lot of Americans when you had conversation from one camp to another, where you might have had some GI who was really siding in with the German, became buddy-buddy with them, you know, and acted as their interpreter and everything else, you know, and became, you want to call them, the camp rat. So you had things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But when it came to medical attention, if you had a cold, or if you had a sprain or something, you were in a lot of trouble. You either healed or there was no such thing really as taking care of you.
Mm-hmm. How about Red Cross packages? Were you given those regularly?
I received one Red Cross parcel.
Mm-hmm.
My mother had sent me, which through the Red Cross, asking them which would be best to send to the prisoner. The best thing you could send a prisoner was cigarettes. The cigarettes was money.
Mm-hmm.
The paper that they gave you, you might as well use for toilet paper, because it meant nothing. But cigarettes, you could buy stuff. And that was the thing. With cigarettes, you can buy bread. You can buy anything you want with cigarettes.
And the Germans were pretty good about giving you these cigarettes?
They didn't know they were in a package. The package was a Red Cross parcel. And if you when you opened it up, there was in the parcel. No, I take it back. I had two parcels.
Mm-hmm.
I got two from all that. 9 months. Mm-hmm. Two parcels. You got...
Who gave you these parcels?
Who gave it to
yeah,
us?
Yeah, was it a regular Red Cross person who would come and give it to
no,
you?
No, this or? The one time it came out of when we were in the main camp, in this English camp. It was given to us by whoever. It seemed like the English ran this camp.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it came through them. Mm-hmm. Now, evidently, the German gave it to their commanding officer,
okay,
who was in charge of their troops. You know, mm-hmm, inside the camp, and they gave it to us.
Mm-hmm.
And we had one.
Mm-hmm.
The second one I got was in Rosenheim. That was given to us by the German officer who was in charge, came, gave it to this corporal, and the corporal then gave us our package.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't get the whole package. They would let us go and take a little bit of something out of it. We got one tin of cookies about that long, and they looked like those wafer cookies,
mm-hmm,
or tea cookies, you're
mm-hmm
in college. You got that. You may have gotten a little a tin of margarine, a tin of jelly, and maybe... I don't remember exactly whether there's two packs of cigarettes in there or not. I think there might have been two. Well, with the cigarettes, if you didn't smoke, you know, you were in shape.
Right.
All you had to do was just trade them off, you
mm-hmm
know. And,
trade them off amongst yourselves or amongst...
Amongst yourselves, you know, or among other, even to the German guard, you know.
Uh-huh. Well,
you want a pack of American cigarettes, give me a loaf of bread, you know.
What I'm driving at is what would prevent the Germans from rifling through the Red Cross packages themselves
nothing
and just taking it?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
They can go in there and take anything, and what are you going to do about it? There's nothing you can do.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that this was done at all? Or?
Oh, I believe that it was done.
Mm-hmm.
If they took away all my personal effects when I was in Muhlberg, they certainly would go through that too.
Certainly, right.
And what are you going to do about it?
Mm-hmm.
And you've got a bunch of troops standing around you, and you've got this guy here at the table, and he says, unload your pockets. Yeah, the interpreter telling you to unload your pockets. Don't hold anything back. So you're taking off your high school ring, putting that on the table. You're taking off your necklace, maybe with your cross on, putting that on the table.
Mm-hmm.
Give me the watch, put that on the table.
Mm-hmm.
Then it gives you a receipt for the money you had.
Mm-hmm.
What about the rest of the stuff? How about my camera? How about everything else I have in my bag? You know.
And what did he say?
You don't get nothing else. That's all. He says, you're not allowed to have this. This will be returned to you later. You know it's not going to return to you.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the fellas put the maybe a little piece of jewelry or whatever they had, like a ring that they wanted, their wedding band or something, they put it in their mouth.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And if you're lucky enough, you get stuff, but if you're rear end, and then try to hope that you're going to get it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way it went.
Mm-hmm.
They just took everything.
Mm-hmm.
They had it. They just... Thievery, as far as I'm concerned, that's all it was.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to all this gold and stuff that they had amassed? Is that the ones that are down in Argentina living off the fat of the land?
Could be. Could be. Okay.
Okay, this is the second part of the Mark Bobick interview. Okay, the last question I wanted to ask you, Mr. Bobick, can you tell me the day... About the day that you were liberated, can you remember that day?
Yeah, that's the day when somebody was coming, and we didn't hear the club.
He always had a lady friend up on the third floor.
He was always giggling and stomping at his boots on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Because things are going to be quiet at that point. Then we can hear the guns out in the distance. The coming morning, usually, so we did, we kicked open the door. We smashed the window and opened the door. Then we opened up the gate, the barbed wire fence, and broke that open. And we went out. And then we saw that the jeeps and the troops that were coming up. And we looked at the passing, it was a 45th infantry. And the first one we saw was a foot soldier, a regular GI, coming up the street with the rifle in front of him. And that was the best damn thing I've seen in a long time. We ran up and hugged them and kissed them and thanked them. And then he told us that the kitchen was just on the way. They were trying to set up a kitchen. We went down there and they gave us some bread, white bread. The bread was like cake. We had it was cake. And we were eating bread. So we ate bread, we went back to our company area to the second camp and picked up our personal effects that we had there. Four of us went to the hospital and we took the doctor's car, German car, and we went in and asked for the keys. They didn't want to give us the keys. Well, we got a hold of the keys anyway.
Mm-hmm.
We jumped in that and we drove to Munich. And from Munich, we left the car there. We went to the airport, the nicest airport there. They had a huge German prison compound. They were all German prisoners, Russian prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a different, entirely different site, you know. So we stayed there, and we stayed overnight, waiting. We hitchhiked a ride from there to Paris. So C-47, so we're going to take off next morning, so we stayed overnight. And the guys made us something to read. They knew it was QW and everything, the real courage. Gave us some kind of a meat, I don't know what it was. But it could have been steak for all I know, I don't know. I'm bread, white bread. We had my first experience with Nescafe. And I had Nescafe, and with milk, believe it or not. Milk at last, you know, I couldn't believe my eyes. It was powdered, but it was still milk. And then from there, there was me and another guy. We hitchhiked a ride to Paris. The only people that were on the plane was a pilot, a co-pilot, and either he was a radio man or a mechanic or something. And they landed at La Bourget Airport, on the outskirts of Paris.
Mm-hmm.
Touchdown, opened the door, we jumped out, and they took off. And we got on the bus. Oh, before we got out, the one guy gave us $50 in French money. So we got out. I wrote to him later on, by the way, and he lived in Michigan. And gave him his money back, too. So I had a souvenir gun. I gave him a souvenir gun. I feel pretty good about this. I gave him a souvenir gun.
What kind of gun was it? A Luger?
No. To me, it looked like a horse pistol. Mike, I never seen a barrel so big, and I was going to put your finger up into it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it was. I do have a Walter souvenir.
Mm-hmm.
And a few other things, armbands and medals and stuff like that. But the plane had taken off. So then this kid from Michigan and I, we had the last three fellas I teamed up with are all from Michigan, which was good. They were close by. One fellow that was in Campbell, he happened to be from Akron down here,
Charles Stoll. I tried to get in touch with him many times. He was working for B.F. Goodrich, but I think he must have married and moved on, you know. I could never find him after that.
From there we went to Paris, and we stayed in Paris for about a week. And they the military police picked us up, and being that we were GIs, they had picked us up and gave us, took our names on, gave us passes.
Mm-hmm.
So we had an unlimited pass to stay in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
So we stayed there for about a week, and they gave us a food card to go to eat in a restaurant, which was their commissary at the time. We went there to eat, and then we were assigned to go on these trucks. We had these semis open back, you know,
mm-hmm.
with the wood sides on the side, and we got on that, and we were sent to Le Havre, France. From Le Havre, they gave us a quick physical and gave us a little bit of a fattened up period there, where they gave a lot of eggnog
mm-hmm.
and you know, stuff like that you can eat, you know.
What kind of physical shape were you in that time?
Well, I was down to about 120 pounds, I guess, somewhere around that neighborhood.
And your normal weight is what?
Well, at that time, around 155 to 160 pounds.
Mm-hmm. So you lost about 35 pounds?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have, there are other people, I'd say, a real weight is. Now, there's one guy, his name is Kajak, and he was, just the opposite worked on him. It must be that the starch in that, the potato diet that we're on
mm-hmm.
must have reacted on his body, because he was blown up. He was like three times the size of what we were. And he was like swollen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the only thing I can figure is that was a reaction of the starch diet on his system. It blew him up like a balloon.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of us were on the thin, you want to call it on the thin side,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to what he looked like.
Mm-hmm. Were you debriefed at all? Given any kind of type of debriefing after?
No. After that, we were sent to, to the States. We were put on a Liberty ship. We came back to the States. It took us 11 days to get back. And I was sent back to Fort Benning, Georgia. When I was at Fort Benning, Georgia, now listen to this. They were going through my records.
Mm-hmm.
And the corporal sitting across the desk from me says, I see here you were assigned a Thompson submachine gun. Where is it? Would you believe?
That sounds like the Army.
So,
he didn't know you were a prisoner?
I don't know, you know.
You know, kicked out of that?
I really did, you know. I began to think back, you know, how that one gun was transferred from my possession to the colonel, and then the colonel gave me his 45, and then going to the company area, the cook giving me his carbine, 30 caliber, then the coming back to my platoon, the platoon taking a carbine, you're not supposed to have that, here's a rifle, you know. Then come back, and then they say, where's your 45 automatic for your Thompson? That was a comedy of errors,
uh-huh.
you know. To be trained to it in a tank and then be put in the infantry was a comedy of errors, too.
Mm-hmm.
I realized that they had to pick up the hole, but...
Would you have rather remained in a tank?
That's what I was trained for. That's what I knew.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
if I was trained for the infantry, then that's where I want to be, because that's where I'm trained.
Mm-hmm.
I know the infantry, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If I was a pilot, which I took a test for and passed in De Ritter, Louisiana, fighter pilot, in February that year, they had turned down everybody who passed the applicants because they had too many.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to go into the fighter pilot, and I did pass it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, as a matter of fact, they took me off the company roll, and they put me on steady KP because I was going to leave
mm-hmm.
and go to the Air Force Academy. But it didn't happen, so as a result, while I was sitting back, and then we finally wound up disbanding and going overseas.
Okay, the last thing I'd like to ask Were you ever questioned by anyone in the military about the treatment you received in these
no.
various
Mm-mm.
camps?
Mm-mm.
Mm-hmm.
No, there was no such thing as asking, you know, what you were treated or did you get medical attention if you needed or
mm-hmm.
and did anybody die? They didn't even question if I who died or anything.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't. To my knowledge, I don't remember it.
Mm-hmm.
If they did ask somebody, it's beyond me to know this, you know. There might have been people that did ask. I don't know. I couldn't answer that question.
Okay. Is there anything you'd like to add that maybe you haven't asked?
Yeah, what I'd like to add is I'd wish the American government, now that they brought the 50 hostages back after all this publicity that they received, would bring back our 500 and some MIAs that are over in Vietnam yet, since the length of time since the war has been over. Let's bring these soldiers home where they belong. Give the wives and the families a break. The wife is sitting at home wondering, is her husband alive or not? May want to remarry. Don't know if he's alive, as if he's living or if he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a heck of a thing to live with. How is she going to conduct her life? There may be other things involved that we don't even know about. And yet, we still have those people over there. Now, there's something wrong there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like it because of what the publicity we received. I am not jealous of the reception that the hostages received as opposed to the military personnel whose duty it was
mm-hmm.
to defend our country, and they did the best that they could. At least they participated. That's more I can say for some congressmen
mm-hmm.
and other people who are enjoying the freedom, who don't know anything about it, who would take it for granted. And if they don't watch the step, it's going to slip out of their fingers. But we have military people over there right now in Vietnam who deserve to come home. And they should get them and give them the opportunity to come home. If they want to stay there on their own free will, then that's another story. But let's round them up first and bring them home. And if they want to stay, then that's their prerogative. But at least it'll be cleared up. This is not 50 I'm talking about. I'm talking over 500.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that would happen.
Hey, thank you very much.
You're welcome.